Lisa.com. It's your life, your health, it's your show. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Dr. Michael Royson, MD.
And this is Dr. Mike. We're really fortunate. One of the stars in the field of Parkinson's disease, in fact, I would not be wrong to say the star, is Dr. Eric Alskog of the Mayo Clinic. He has written a second edition or updated an edition of his classic book, The Parkinson's Disease Treatment Book. It's really a book that informs patients and caregivers about the disease so that they can better collaborate with their doctors to find the best treatment plan for them. There have been 10 years since the original edition was published and became a success and has really helped a lot of people. So this is about the new treatments and new things that have developed. Obviously, there's some classic individuals who we think of when we think of Parkinson's disease, Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox. And so, Dr. Alskog, how are they both doing with the disease, and what is the natural course? They seem to be living a long time at a relatively stable level. Is that true?
Well, it's great to be with you. Neither one are my patients, so I can talk about them, can't I? Michael J. Fox, according to the newspapers, developed Parkinson's disease symptoms over 2 decades ago, and he still acts on The Good Wife, and he still is a fabulous actor, and he obviously has a good life, and especially a good one, dedicating so much of his resources to looking for the cure for Parkinson's disease. Muhammad Ali, he isn't doing as well, and I don't understand that, and I don't know what treatments he's had, so I can't comment about him. But I will tell you that the vast majority of people in our clinic here at Mayo in Rochester, Minnesota, I think do pretty well with Parkinson's disease. And I've always thought that if you have Parkinson's disease, you know, this should not be a sentence to a sedentary life, but it really should be a wake-up call to enlarging upon your life, get involved with a lot of activities, engage in exercise, and then by all means make certain that you and your physician have a meeting of the minds on appropriate medical therapy.
So one of the things that is relatively new, or at least probably is a little different from 10 years ago, is the exercise program that is prescribed now routinely for Parkinson's patients.
Routinely or not, I guess I don't know. That's certainly a huge component of what I talk to folks about, aerobic exercise. So, you know, for decades, you know, therapists have been instructing people with Parkinson's disease and related disorders on balance exercises and stretching and toning, and that's all important, but aerobic exercise is something that is just coming into public visibility, and it's not just in Parkinson's disease, obviously. It's for normal aging, prolonging longevity, a pretty important endpoint, the muscle wasting that occurs with normal aging, loss of bone integrity, which is to say osteoporosis, coronary artery disease, and there's a massive literature where you could argue that exercise is the sole therapeutic strategy that we know of that may provide you with a more favorable course of Parkinson's disease. In other words, it may slow the progression.
Would
you like me to enlarge upon that?
Sure.
I think I will.
Maybe you could talk about, at least as I remember reading, there's some things about it causing a regrowth or slowing the destruction of the dopaminergic neurons, which are part and parcel of the disease.
Well, let me take a slightly broader view about this as well, too. Now, dopamine, you know, we should just spend a minute talking about that. It's a neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's a very infrequent neurotransmitter in the brain. The vast, vast majority of brain neurotransmitters are not dopamine. So dopamine, as a neurotransmitter, as a signaling chemical, occupies far less than 1% of all the chemical neurotransmitters in the brain. But it's nodally placed, and it modulates the movement of the body So when you lose dopamine, your movements slow down. The amplitude of movements attenuates. That's like the stride length and the arm swing shorten. And automatic movements like blinking and arm swing and facial animation are attenuated. If you restore dopamine, that can restore all of those movements. Now, Parkinson's disease can be a lot more than a dopamine deficiency. So the underlying process that's going on becomes visible when that attacks the dopamine system. And that's when we make the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, when people develop gait problems or tremor or other motor symptoms. But there is a progression of Parkinson's disease that goes beyond dopamine, and that's when you run into trouble. We can replenish dopamine for people that you can't stabilize that. There's deep brain stimulation, brain surgery. But the problem that I have in the clinic is when it goes beyond the dopamine systems and into areas where there is another neurotransmitter, of course, we can't replenish other neurotransmitters. So what am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about movement problems that don't respond to dopamine because the neurotransmitter system that is being affected is not dopamine. Number two, dementia, cognitive impairment. And number three, autonomic problems. The autonomic nervous system controls bowel, bladder, blood pressure, sweating. And when that gets affected, dopamine is not the neurotransmitter, and replenishing dopamine doesn't help. So the progression of Parkinson's disease goes far beyond dopamine, and just doing things that are directed at the dopamine system aren't going to help dementia, low blood pressure, problems with Parkinsonian symptoms that don't respond to levodopa. So what we need to do is look at the big picture and come up with a strategy that slows that overall progression. So that's where ongoing aerobic exercise becomes a treatment modality.
And how does it become a treatment modality? What does it do to slow these progressions?
Well, there's a rather substantial literature. If you wanted me to cite papers, I could come up with well over 100 scientific...
No.
And medical. I'm not going to do that. Don't worry. But I could do that because there are well over 100 papers that have been written where you could come up with a very compelling argument that ongoing aerobic exercise changes the what's going on in the brain. So, for example, we know from animal studies that if animals are exercised, there is an increase in trophic factors in the brain. What are trophic factors? Well, that's like putting fertilizer on your lawn. Synaptic proteins, those are things that are involved in the connections in the brain. Those are things that are liberated in animals that exercise. There are human studies that show that people that are physically fit in midlife or exercise in midlife have a lower, substantially lower risk later on of developing dementia, mild cognitive impairment, and even Parkinson's disease. So I could go on and on, but there's a whole host of studies that would argue that the single thing you can do to slow progression of Parkinson's disease is engage in ongoing aerobic exercise.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Alsag. The book is called The New Parkinson's Disease Treatment Book. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. I'm actually a minute early, Dr. Alsag, so I'm going to keep asking you questions. Sorry, I got it wrong this week for the second week in a row. I usually don't get it wrong. Dr. Alsag, you said it is the single most important thing, but there are other therapies that are used in addition. So when we come back, let's take a patient with this, if you will, a theoretic patient, and say, how does this book help us understand the progression and what we should do in the treatment of Parkinson's disease if a loved one gets it or you're a caregiver for someone with it? We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD.
This is Meryl Streep. Over the years, I have played some characters you could call controlling, but the truth is, there's so much in life we can't control. But here's something we can. colorectal cancer. It affects men and women, and it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., which is astounding, considering it's almost entirely preventable. Here's how. Most colon cancers start as polyps, and screening helps find polyps so they can be removed before they even turn into cancer. Screening also finds this cancer early, when treatment works best. For me, screening was simple and quick. It was no big deal, except for the huge sense of relief you feel afterwards. There are several tests that you can choose from. If you're 50 or older, you should talk to your doctor. Decide which one's right for you. Take control. Do everything you can to prevent colon cancer. Screening saves lives. It could really save your life. For more information, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
Okay, here goes. I know more about cooking dinner for a party of 12 than I do about packing a lunch for a 12-year-old. I know kids like things like PB&J, pigs in a blanket. Oh, and fish sticks. They do love fish sticks. Fillets I get, but sticks? What part of the fish does the stick come from? I know I can read a cookbook that'll tell me how to make a red wine reduction, but where are the cookbooks that can teach me how to cut the crusts off bologna sandwiches? Oh, maybe we can compromise on mac and cheese. Can you make that with brie? Everybody likes brie, right?
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to push your food around their plate. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, with Michael Roizen, M.D. Here's Dr. Mike.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, where we help you take control of your health. I'm talking with Dr. Eric Alslog of the Mayo Clinic. His book, The Parkinson's Disease Treatment Book. Actually, it's the new Parkinson's Disease Treatment Book. It's a wonderful rendition, if you will. After 10 years of being on the market, it's a great book that he had. He's updated it to include all of the latest information to give. And one of the things they do in this edition is gives you new information about how to manage things. So I thought I'd ask Dr. Alslog to give us a quick summary of what happens with a new patient.
Okay, well, I'm right here. So let's say somebody comes to see me in the office, and this is what I do all day, every day during the week. So I can tell you I'm pretty familiar with this approach. So the obviously one makes the diagnosis first, and the diagnosis is often clinical, meaning that it's the history, what patients tell you, and the examination, which is a component of the neurologic exam. And at that point, often there aren't any additional tests that one needs to do. Now, obviously, if there are some unusual features, then tests are done. But quite often in Parkinson's disease, that is adequate. Once I make the diagnosis, then it's a question of, do people need to be treated? So if there's something that's more of a curiosity, if it's just a limited tremor and not very much else beyond that, if they're walking well, and if their activities of daily living and quality of life are good, one does not necessarily need to treat them. But there are two criteria that I use for treatment. So number one is their quality of life compromised by Parkinson's disease? And number two, you know, we talked briefly about exercise. Well, I think all these folks that I see need to engage in regular, ongoing aerobic exercise, so I want them to be in a position to do that. And if they have a shuffling gait and they can't walk very well and they feel crummy, who's going to engage in exercise? So that's a second criterion for who I treat. All right. Well, let's say that they've met one or both of those criteria, and then the question is, what does one choose? Well, the reason I wrote both these books was to make certain that people know what the different medications are for Parkinson's disease treatment and which medicines work and which medicines work marginally. Well, it turns out that the best medicine for Parkinson's disease is still that old standard levodopa. So levodopa was introduced in the 1960s. It was FDA approved in about 1969, and here we are 40 years later, still the best drug for Parkinson's disease. So levodopa, which is now carbidopa levodopa, 40 years later, this is still the best drug, and it is to Parkinson's disease what insulin is to type 1 diabetes mellitus. And so this last book that I, the last edition that I wrote that I cleverly titled the new Parkinson's disease treatment book as opposed to the Parkinson's disease treatment book, this particular version, I really emphasize the need to get levodopa right. And levodopa in this day and age is carbidopa levodopa. Carbidopa is there. Does carbidopa doesn't get into the brain, levodopa does, but carbidopa is there to protect levodopa. And you have to get the carbidopa levodopa dosing scheme right. And my goal is to get people as close to perfect as I can. And there was a school of thought that still surfaces online, and some clinicians, I think, still adhere to this. But they would say that, well, we should save levodopa for later, and when we use it, we should be very conservative with the dose. So I don't think that really is in the best interests of people with Parkinson's disease. So I want people to be active. And I, you know, life is pretty short. We, you know, we're going to live, guys live about 80 years and gals live a couple years longer. And if you relegate people to, you know, 5 years of their life where they're going to be doing poorly because you're under-treating them, well, you're not doing anybody any favors. So my thought is, let's use the best drug, use it appropriately, don't use more than you need, but use the optimum dose. And the discussion that I then have in the clinic with these folks that I'm starting on treatment really focuses on how to use carbidopa levodopa. Is it worthwhile getting into any details about that, do you think?
I think we're fine on that because that will be what is occupied by people who actually get the disease or have caregivers that want to know more. But Let's go, and so where does exercise fit into this? Do you put everyone on an exercise program before they go on carbidopa or levodopa, or is that a adjunct to the drug therapy? Which comes first?
Well, I recognize there's some people I see in the clinic, they're not in a position to exercise. So if I tell them to do that, they're going to go to the gym or whatever they choose to do, they're going to be frustrated because it's just too hard and they're not going to do it. So what I typically do is I'll have this discussion, but I'll say, okay, let's get you as good as we can get you, and then we're going to do this seriously. And I want people to think of themselves as not I'm a Parkinson's patient, but I am who I am, and by the way, I have Parkinson's disease. And so I want them engaging in whatever they choose. You know, for a while there were several exercises that were in vogue. You know, the press got a hold of these, riding a tandem bicycle, tango dancing, and so on. But really, the science would suggest that anything that makes you hot, sweaty, and tired, which really defines aerobic exercise, is going to be good for your body. And it's, obviously, it's not just Parkinson's disease, but I firmly believe that the scientific literature suggests that you can maintain the integrity of many important brain circuits and forestall some of the progression of Parkinson's disease, some of the progression of normal aging if you stay physically active. So the exercise
so I like
is that something
definition.
That when you're ready
hot,
to start exercising,
and
then you do it.
Hot, sweaty, and tired. I like that. We've been doing it by heart rate response, but hot, sweaty, and tired, or clearly sweaty in a cool room, seems to be a key for increasing those trophic factors your brain puts out. And I guess it works in Parkinson's disease as well as in preventing dementia.
Well, I believe that it does. And heart rate, that's a good parameter as well, except for people like me who are on a blood pressure medicine like Atenolol or Metoprolol or one of the others that block the beta receptors and keep your heart rate low.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Eric Oswag of the Mayo Clinic, I want to thank you for publishing such a great book, the new Parkinson's disease treatment book. clearly, if you have a loved one with this or are worried about it, this is a great book to get. And secondly, for taking the time to educate us so well, thanks very much. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD. We have a second hour and a wonderful hour with my favorite usual guest, that is guest every week, Dr. Gary Ginsberg, What's Toxic, What's Not, telling us about which is the best hand sanitizer to use in your home. We'll be right back. Thanks very much. And Dr. Alsag, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Dr. Mike.
Find
thank
him
you for having
at the
me.
Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.